The Financial Sense Midweek Edition with Jim Poplava. Delving in-depth with authors and experts into the key economic issues.
I'm Eric Townsend for the Financial Sense NewsHour. The Next Level is a new weekly program segment intended for investment professionals and more advanced private investors. This week's topic is hyperinflation versus sustained high inflation. Joining me as my special guest on the program is Eric Jansen, founder of iTulip.com. Eric, thanks for joining me on The Next Level.
My pleasure, Eric.
Because we happen to share the same first name, to avoid the confusion of Eric talking to Eric, I'm going to be addressing Mr. Jansen by his initials, EJ, which is also how he's known to subscribers at iTulip.com. Longtime Financial Sense listeners already know that inflation versus deflation has been a hotly debated topic in the finance community for several years now. But of the discussions that we hear about the so-called endgame, it usually centers on predictions either of a deflationary spiral or an epic hyperinflation that wipes out the U.S. dollar. Only a few analysts in the inflation camp even discuss the very important distinction between hyperinflation and the entirely different phenomenon of sustained very high inflation. I think you're going to find EJ's views on that subject extremely interesting. EJ, there are still several economists that are expecting a deflationary outcome, so let's start by framing this conversation with why you're in the inflation rather than deflation camp to start with.
Well, Eric, you have to keep in mind, I've been involved in this particular debate now for 12 years, and it started back during the stock market bubble back in the late 1990s, and there was some concern that when that bubble crashed that there would be a deflationary spiral like in the 1930s. I argued at the time that since the U.S. was not on the gold standard, there was nothing to prevent the central bank from adding as many zeros onto the liabilities side of its ledger as it pleased in order to expand its balance sheet. It could not do that under the gold standard because those entries had to be backed by gold. As it turned out, when the bubble did crash, and we did have a very short period of deflation, which I, in my Capoon theory, refer to as a disinflation, it was very short. The Fed printed a bunch of money, which it does in modern times by adding a bunch of zeros onto its ledger, and instantaneously expanded its balance sheet and grew the money supply. We had a repeat of this argument during the housing bubble when we had this gigantic mountain of securitized mortgage debt and some concern about what would happen when that market collapsed and we had a liquidity crisis. And again, I argued that there was nothing to prevent the central bank from adding more zeros to its ledger. And in fact, that's what it did to an extent that it exceeded even my expectations, adding trillions of dollars onto its balance sheet and buying up all these bad loans and worthless securities and putting them on its balance sheet. So the answer to the question is there's nothing to prevent the central bank from printing as much money as it pleases. But as Greenspan famously said to the Senate back in the early 2000s, they can guarantee cash benefits as far out and to whatever size our legislature wants, but we cannot guarantee its purchasing power.
Okay, so essentially your argument is that there's no limit to how much money the Fed can print. Now, the deflationists' favorite and perhaps most compelling argument is that aggregate money and credit is being extinguished as a result of deleveraging and default even faster than Ben Bernanke is printing new money to replace it. How would you respond to that objection?
In that framework is a misunderstanding of how money is created in our hybrid fiat combination of government and private credit market. Money is lent into existence either by the government or by the private sector or some combination of the two. So under our system, when the private sector is not lending new money into existence and in fact money is shrinking because loans are being paid off or loans are being defaulted on more quickly than new loans are being made and the money supply is being expanded, the government can step in and fulfill this role. The government can borrow money into existence. So the answer is that yes, it has been continuously, quite surprisingly, since 2008, a continuous decline in the total amount of private sector debt outstanding. And this has never happened before. So we have debt deflation in the private sector, and the government has stepped in and expanded the money supply through government borrowing to compensate for it ever since.
Now, the other argument might be that we could have a change in policy attitude. Now, Ron Paul is out of the presidential race, but his principal campaign promise was to take away Ben Bernanke's printing press. In your opinion, is there any room for a hawkish changing of the guard here among policymakers? Or do you think at this point there's basically no choice but for the government to print more money, regardless of who's in the White House?
To my way of thinking, we got into this bind way back in the early part of the 2000s when we had the first bubble in stocks. This set us on a course where government was going to have to step in and expand the money supply through government borrowing over and over again in order to keep the economy growing and keep the money supply growing. It is, of course, exactly what Richard Tu had warned us about back in 2003 and what Japan has been doing continuously now for over 20 years. So Ron Paul's role in our political system is to bring in topics into the debate that otherwise wouldn't be there. So he represents a very hardline view about the Federal Reserve. My own view about the Federal Reserve is not that you should abolish it, but that it needs very drastic reform. My concern about abolishing it is it would be immediately replaced with something even worse. So I think you're better off trying to fix what you got versus trying to bring something new in. I think the worst solution would be to have the government itself, of course, fulfilling this role. You can imagine a system where your politicians have one hand on the spend lever and the other hand on the print lever. And this is what is one of the reasons why we have central banks. Every country on earth has a central bank for this reason, to provide some level of indirection between the desire of the legislature to fulfill any promise to the voters and the ability of the central bank to meet that by printing money. So you need some layer in between. You may argue that the Fed is not the ideal layer, but again, I think it needs to be reformed and not abolished. But it is worthwhile and useful to have Ron Paul in the discussion, putting that out there and taking that hard view, because without it, there's no discussion of it at all.
So before we go any further, I think we should start with some definitions. I was reading Zero Hedge the other day, and they were talking about how we're going to get hyperinflation as high as 18% as a result of this. A few weeks ago, I read another piece that said we were going to get hyperinflation that would be even worse than the hyperinflation we had in the 1970s. So I think there seems to be a lot of misconception out there about the true definition of the term hyperinflation. Please describe for our listeners how hyperinflation differs from high inflation, what rates of consumer price appreciation are typical in hyperinflation, and what causes each phenomenon to occur.
Well, we did not have a hyperinflation back in the 1970s. We had high inflation, and it actually never even got up to 20%. But the definition of hyperinflation varies. PricewaterhouseCoopers says it's 100% annual rate, 100% or higher. I think that's probably as good a definition as any. And by that definition, even Argentina back in 2001, when they had their high inflation, did not actually have a hyperinflation. Generally speaking, hyperinflations are the flip side of a deflation spiral. It's a completely out of control inflationary process that does not respond to the standard measures used by central banks to stop an inflation process. In other words, there's no way for them to raise short-term rates above the prevailing rate of inflation quickly enough to calm markets down and convince them that there's the discipline there to lower inflation.
So would you say that we're really talking about two different things, with hyperinflation representing a loss of faith in a currency where everybody just wants out of that currency, whereas high inflation is a sustainable phenomenon that could go on for several years and then revert back to a normal condition?
Till quite recently, and then by that I mean the last 20 years or so, inflation rates such as in Korea of 20 to 40% are pretty normal. And the economies functioned fairly well, but these were industrial economies. They didn't have a very large fire sector, and it didn't really matter that much that inflation was high. If you have a highly levered economy with a lot of debt in it, you really can't have high inflation like that. In fact, subsequent to the big reset that we had back in the early 1980s, where all there were massive sovereign defaults across the world, and inflation rates came down from double digits to single digits and has pretty much stayed there. Before that period of time, there were quite a few industrial economies were able to work with relatively high levels of inflation without much difficulty.
Now, before we go on, I want to understand why this distinction is important. If you're an investor designing a portfolio for what's coming in the next few years, why do you need to care whether it's high inflation or hyperinflation?
Well, they're very different processes. A hyperinflation is a complete wipeout. And one of the things that troubles me about these somewhat casual discussions about hyperinflation is simply a degree of inflation relative to a high inflation. Again, an economy can operate with relatively high inflation, 20, 30, 40, 50% for years at a time without suffering really significant hardship. A hyperinflation just wipes out an entire generation. The wealth is gone. And this occurred in Germany, of course, in the 1920s, also in Japan after World War II. And in countries where this has occurred, the effect is so devastating and leaves such a massive mark on an entire generation that subsequently all monetary policy is extremely phobic about inflation. This is why you see Japan managing inflation very, very low for long periods of time, and also Germany with a bias toward hawkishness and managing inflation down, because there's this cultural stigma that's been created by this wipeout of a generation's wealth. So to talk about hyperinflation as simply a degree of inflation doesn't really explain the cultural impact and the effect that it has on a country and on an economy.
Now, moving on to present circumstances, central banks have printed trillions of dollars out of thin air since 2008, leading several analysts to predict a U.S. dollar hyperinflation. They cite epic hyperinflations of Argentina, Chile, Zimbabwe, and perhaps most famously the one you mentioned, the Weimar Germany hyperinflation of 1923. They say that these are all examples of what happens when governments do exactly what we're doing right now, which is resorting to the printing press in a desperate move to make up for decades of reckless fiscal policy. Many of our listeners are familiar with economist John Williams, who's predicted a U.S. dollar hyperinflation to begin by 2014. Now, based on history, at least at first glance, these seem like very compelling arguments. Why do you have a different view?
Well, because it ignores all of history. Every hyperinflation that's ever occurred has followed from a currency collapse, not from excessive printing by the central bank. So the preconditions for every hyperinflation are, first of all, you have to have a ruined economy with virtually no output, and therefore there's no foreign investment because there's no reason to invest in an economy that's not growing. 99% of the time, this is because this country has lost a war. So there's a very strong correlation between losing war and hyperinflation. The second requirement is political isolation, and that means that nobody's interested in helping you or owning your currency. And since there's no outside demand for your currency, needless to say, it's going to collapse. So the first thing that happens is the currency collapses, and cost push inflation begins a inflation cycle. The central bank has no choice but to print enough money to continue to circulate goods and services at the new higher price level that's been caused by this currency collapse. And this is what gets a hyperinflation cycle going. So imagine this happening to the U.S. The U.S. economy is, even in its worst days, even if it were to shrink by 25%, is not going to be in a situation where its output is virtually zero relative to other countries. In fact, you can, any scenario where the U.S. economy is doing that badly, everyone else is going to be doing much worse. Secondly, 15% of global GDP is not being held in dollar reserves outside the U.S. So there's already a massive investment in dollars currently. So the U.S. is not going to meet the criteria that there's no demand for dollars. Finally, the U.S. is not a little country like Argentina with a small GDP relative to world GDP, an insignificant player that is going to get thrown under the bus the way Argentina was by the IMF back in 2001. The U.S. has a very important strategic, military, and economic and political position in the world. So, again, the main criteria for hyperinflation simply aren't there for the U.S. But let's say that for some reason the U.S. finds its economy at a stop, completely politically isolated from the rest of the world, with no demand for dollars anywhere. Should it find itself in that position, which of course would be the worst case scenario, the purpose of the 8,000 tons of gold is to halt a runaway dollar crisis. So this is also the reason why the second most important central bank and country in the international monetary system, Germany, also happens to have the second largest gold reserve. After that, it's the IMF. So these relationships between gold reserves and the significance of different players in the international monetary system are not coincidental. It is also not coincidental that Argentina, subsequent to its crisis, went from having no gold to buying 55 tons of it in 2004. Any country that has sufficient gold reserves can halt a runaway currency crisis simply by backing its currency and stopping the process.
And so the mechanism through which the gold comes into play is if they're willing to offer redeemability of currency for gold, that basically revitalizes the value of the currency. Is that the correct interpretation of what you said? And does that create a risk that there's a run on that and somebody basically buys all the gold?
Well, the trick, Eric, is to set the price at a level that calms everyone down. So for the U.S., it would be equivalent to reopening the gold window that was closed in 1971 at a price that motivates anyone who's holding dollar-denominated securities to not want to redeem them for the gold, but simply being offered the opportunity to do so should cause them to want to keep what they have. So you can redeem your securities for gold, but you're going to have to take a significant discount to do it. Some players will make that choice. But the way that the arrangement will be set up will be to motivate holders of dollar-denominated securities to then redeem them for gold.
So it's essentially calling a currency collapse as bluff by reopening the gold window and evidencing that there is backing behind the currency. You've basically described a very good argument for why you think hyperinflation is a very low or perhaps impossible probability. What then do you think is the most probable outcome in terms of what we're facing in the next several years?
My Kaplan theory is a theory that we go through these cycles of disinflation as the economy shrinks and the money supply shrinks, and the government and the Federal Reserve have to step in and lend new money into existence in order to stop the process. The economy grows for a while, but has become dependent on government for expanding the money supply. So not only to finance economic growth itself, and there's a certain amount of output that's dependent on finance, on government finance, but also the money supply itself has become dependent on government borrowing. So at some point, each one of these cycles where the government has to step in to keep the windsock inflated, it becomes less and less effective. And each time it becomes more inflationary and less re-inflationary in terms of the impact on improving output and the ability of the U.S. to pay its existing debts. Eventually, what happens is that the U.S. simply runs out of buyers of treasury issuance and has to buy much too much of it itself, or it has to reduce issuance. And in that case, the markets will start to heavily discount the dollar, and then there will be in a real bind.
Do you think that when this process has run its course, that it will have what I assume is its intended purpose, which is to inflate the national debt down to a serviceable level so that we can return to economic prosperity? Do you think it will achieve that goal?
The policy, if you think about it, going back to 2001, has been a gradual depreciation of the dollar and to deflate our external debts very gradually, not suddenly, against the dollar. It's depreciated about 40% since 2001. And back in 2001, I forecast a 40% decline start to finish through the process. But I think I underestimated the extent and the length of it. I think we've got another 40% to go. I think the goal is to get the dollar back down to around 60 by 2015 or so. So the idea is if you can do this gradually enough, deflating the debt against a depreciating dollar, in theory, improving our net export position and at the same time working to reduce our dependency on foreign oil so that we can improve our net trade position. And then all these things together are supposed to help to reorient our economy away from the current predicament that we're in. But I think that ultimately what happens is that it doesn't work, and that we find ourselves at the end of this process with a weak dollar, foreign debt instead of, you know, 10 or 15% of GDP, 30 or 40 or even 50% of GDP, and foreign creditors extremely worried that we will be motivated to repay domestic creditors before foreign creditors. That is the setup for a bond crisis.
And would you anticipate then a conditional or a partial default where at some point the government says we're going to honor our domestic but not our foreign debt obligations?
Well, you know, debt defaults are a complicated process. Usually they happen in stages. There's a bit of bargaining over, okay, so we're just going to pay principal and not the interest, or just the interest and not the principal on this debt. And we're going to do some swaps of these long-term bonds for some short-term bonds and so on. So that process, the default process, is a long, drawn-out process, can go on for many years.
Many of our listeners are familiar with Reinhardt and Rogoff's book, This Time is Different, which chronicles 800 years of monetary history. It basically anticipates a currency crisis unless some very big policy changes happen very quickly, which don't seem to be happening. Would you agree with their general thesis, and would you say that your view of what happens fits into their predictive model, or would you say that you have a different view, and why do you agree or disagree with their perspective on this?
Well, I was writing about sudden stops in the context of the U.S. several years before Reinhardt and Rogoff were. My interpretation of their book is that it's largely political. They're really about providing political ammo to Beltway conservatives who are pushing a reduced spending, budget-cutting agenda. I'm much more in the what's going to happen business than in the politics business. My treatment of it is not ideological. I view their treatment as sort of the flip side of modern monetary theory, which is equally steeped in mysticism and ideology, in my view. The fact is that under our system, that the world's reserve currency issuer, the largest country in the world, the largest economy in the world, the largest exporter in the world, is not going to overnight have this kind of crisis. It will happen in stages and steps. And if you think about it, it's been going on already for 10 years. In terms of the policy response, the right thing to do, of course, is to gradually write down all this debt that has been built up in the private sector over the last 30 years and find some constructive way to write down mortgage debt against inflated housing prices. That would be a good place to start. But also in other sectors of the other parts of the private sector, so that the government isn't in a position of having to backstop the private sector credit markets with government debt.
An increasing number of analysts have come to the conclusion that we're finally coming up against the so-called Malthusian limits to growth, meaning that natural resource scarcity, and particularly peak cheap oil, which I know is a subject that you've written extensively about, will prevent a return to economic growth as we used to know it. Dwindling natural resources presumably dictate continuing high inflation. So some people are even saying that economic growth as we used to know it is a thing of the past. Do you subscribe to those views, and why or why not?
Well, Eric, the international monetary system was not designed to cope with sustained high cost push inflation from sustained high energy prices. And that's what we've been coping with for the last decade. I mean, if you remember back during the recession in 2001, it was not a very steep recession, but oil prices fell down to $12 a barrel. In the last massive recession that we had, oil prices only fell to $40, not 10 or 12. And to me, that was strongly indicative of what was happening in the oil markets, that the markets understood that we were approaching, or were probably in the middle of, a plateau in output, even with technologies for exploration and production improving at a steady rate. The fact is that we know where all the oil is, and there ain't any more than we have, and the markets have already figured out what it's going to cost to get that out of the ground. The problem is that for countries that are exporting, this, you know, puts an particularly unfair burden on countries that are exporting oil. For example, the dollar reserves among the resource exporting countries as a group increased from 8% collectively as a part of their collective GDP to 37% over the last 6 years. And none of these countries, is like Brazil, can put these reserves to work domestically without producing even worse inflation than they already have. So it's putting enormous strains on the international monetary system, and I think is motivating the development of a bunch of parallel systems. This is having the unintended effect of reducing demand for dollars and may accelerate dollar depreciation beyond the rate that is considered a good thing by U.S. policymakers.
I'd like to run my own theory past you, which is, you know, as far as I can see, senior policymakers probably have a pretty good understanding of just how dire our debt dilemma really is. Their public statements don't really reveal that, but I think they know what's going on. But I'm just afraid that they have no clue that peak cheap oil is coming down the pike, and they have no idea how dramatically it's going to affect the global economy. And I worry that our government's long-term plan is to return us to economic prosperity by having a plan for how they're going to inflate away the debt, but they have no plan for peak cheap oil. And I'm afraid that's going to derail their overall strategy and lead to a massive global depression. Now, am I crazy to think these things?
Well, Eric, one of the things I do is I give speeches, and well, several of the groups I addressed included a number of high-level military personnel that I've maintained relationships with. And it's pretty clear from my communications with them that Big Cheap Oil has been on their radar for at least 10 years from a strategic military standpoint. The legislative and executive branches of government have been a bit slower to get in gear, but I think they have. And I think this is why we have this public discussion of the importance of U.S. energy independence and why we're hearing so much about the U.S. being able to develop independence from foreign oil using domestic natural gas and so forth. So I think this is all part of the development of public awareness to prepare us for legislative decisions in the future to address it. And these will be a combination first of a change in attitudes about consumption. And I think there'll be a cultural shift away from high consumption, big cars to smaller cars. And also our views about drilling for oil in the U.S. will change. And I think that we'll do a lot more than we have in the past. And that will be accepted publicly because the groundwork will have been done to prepare the voting populace to understand that the need. So I think that between conservation and domestic supplies, that we'll be able to put off an acute crisis for 10 years or so. But subsequent to that, I think we're going to have some real difficulties. It's just hard to get your head around exactly when that's going to happen or how that's going to play out.
Moving back to interest rates and inflation, a lot of speculators have figured out that higher inflation and higher interest rates are inescapable eventualities. And your prognosis certainly supports that conclusion. Traders are starting to call a top in the 30-year bull market in bonds, and some of them are starting to short long treasury bonds, speculating that interest rates have bottomed. But some very famous investors, including Jim Rogers, have already been burned by being too early in that trade. And what concerns me the most about that trade is that the situation in Europe, I think, is going to end very badly. And that means capital flight that could push U.S. Treasury yields even lower. So what would you say to speculators that are calling a top in the bond bull market? Do you think we've really seen a top, or do you think the blow-off top is still ahead of us?
Well, Eric, I chalk this up to inexperience. I think these guys are probably pretty young and haven't been at this for very long. We took our long bond position back in the year 2000 after we dumped all of our Cisco and Nortel and other stock back in the early part of the year 2000. So we've been long U.S. Treasury bonds for more than a decade and have watched traders come and go who look at this very long bull market in bonds and see a top from time to time. I think that what they don't understand is that the U.S. economy has fundamentally been on life support since the year 2001, and that there are a nearly infinite number of ways for a government to fix bond prices and therefore yields, and therefore shorting that process and shorting government by shorting bonds is really a pretty dangerous game. We took our gold position in 2001 as our short government position, as our way of shorting bonds on the flip side, because you have to know that in the process of trying to fix bond prices above the market rate, that this necessarily has to result in a weakening of the exchange rate value of the dollar against gold. So these are the two flip sides of this process that's been going on for a decade. Now, to your point, looking out from here, you look at these extraordinarily low yields on long-term U.S. government debt, and it appears from a historical standpoint, it's hard to imagine how those yields could go lower, how prices could possibly go higher. But as you say, you know, the euro was very badly structured, and it was designed to operate in perpetual good times. I mean, it was launched during the biggest global economic expansion in generations, and everyone was feeling pretty good about it at the time. There were a few skeptics. Then we had the American financial crisis, which was quite devastating to some of the weaker economies in Europe, and in particular Spain, which was also running its own massive housing bubble. So these economies went from being able to afford the debts they took on during the halcyon years of after the euro was launched, into being unable to support the debts that they took on. And this is putting enormous strains on the euro itself. The euro is not well structured politically. It's poorly structured in every way, but is not designed to sustain the kind of political pressure that is occurring between the net exporters and the net debtors and net creditors within the Eurozone. And as you say, this is going to cause many investors in Europe to look for safe havens, and if they're moving into dollars and also into gold. So I think this would be a particularly perilous time to be shorting U.S. bonds. There will come a time to do it, but we're not there yet.
So for now, it sounds like your advice would be if you're tempted to go short U.S. long bonds, you'd be better off to go long gold to play the same basic macro argument.
That's right. I mean, it's the way to accomplish it without all the risk you take of betting against the house.
Final question. Many of our listeners are finance professionals and very serious private investors who can see that we're on the cusp, really, of a new multi-decade era of rising inflation and rising interest rates. It obviously behooves them to learn as much as they can about the subject, but this is not just the basic theory of inflation, interest rates, and business cycle that you find in the basic introductory economic texts. This is about a structural transition that's being forced by credit expansion reaching its limits of sustainability. And that means that we need to understand how credit markets will react when monetary policy is limited by that forcing function. EJ, you've done an incredible amount of research in the last few years relating to interest rates and inflation and hyperinflation and so forth. What would your advice be to people who really want to dig deep on this and learn a lot about it? Are there any particular books or other reference sources that you'd recommend for people that want to go deeper into this?
Well, my favorite book is History of Interest Rates, which was originally written back in the early 1980s and has been republished in several editions since then. It's a massive tome, but it's extremely comprehensive and rigorous and talks about interest rates going all the way back to the earliest days of history. And the most important takeaway from it is that interest rates can stay very high or very low for long periods of time, and economies and contracts and expectations get built around interest rates, and they become accepted as norm by a generation. You know, when I was growing up, we had very high interest rates. We had interest rates in the teens. If you bought a house, you were paying 12-13% on a 15 or 30 year mortgage, and that was considered normal. Then you look at older folks who had bought houses back in the 1950s, and their mortgage rates were 4 or 5%, and it was hard to imagine as a youngster that interest rates were ever so low. My theory is that right about the time it becomes accepted that interest rates will always be low, that there's a turning point. And it isn't always instantaneous or very quick, but it occurs, and interest rates start to rise, and then they fall, and then they start to rise a little more, a little bit like a tide coming in after a tide going out. So imagine a tide that goes out for 30 years. When it changes, it starts to come in again. It doesn't happen all at once. It's almost imperceptible. But I think it will occur. It'll probably happen within the next couple of years. And then interest rates will start to climb and climb and climb for an extended period of time. And I think with this inflation that I'm expecting, we'll peak at pretty high rates in double digits. Again, I'm thinking in the 20s, although, again, it's hard to say exactly when.
And you would expect how many years of interest rates north of 20% before this is over?
Let me put it to you this way, Eric. Imagine it's 1981, and you've had years of high inflation. You have this new guy running the Fed, this guy named Paul Volcker, and you know, people don't really know much about him. He's doing the same kinds of things that Arthur Burns had done, his predecessor, raising interest rates high above the rate of inflation for a period of time, putting the economy into recession. But what they didn't understand about him is that he intended to keep the economy in recession as long as it took to break inflation expectations. He did this for 3 years. In 1981, after he'd been on this program for 6 months, there was still a lot of, there wasn't much confidence in that. There wasn't really understanding of what he was about and what his mission was. And in that time, you could buy a non-callable 30-year U.S. Treasury bond that paid 13%, and you still held that bond up until about a year ago. So everybody was wrong. Everyone was projecting high rates of inflation off for the next 30 years. What I see today is this majority of so-called expert fixed income and investors projecting low inflation out 30 years by paying what they do for these bonds. And I call it the everyone is wrong again trade. The problem is knowing when to get out of that and get on the other side of the trade. And what is the other side of that trade? I've felt since 2001 when we bought gold that gold is the other side of that trade, and that at some point the price of gold is going to reflect at the real level of inflation risk and default risk in dollars and in U.S. dollar-denominated treasuries and securities in general. Again, my guess is that that happens somewhere between 2013 and 2015 after the next election.
Boy, AJ, I would absolutely love to keep going and dig deeper into your Kapoom theory, which models the U.S. dollar endgame, your peak cheap oil analysis, which I've found extremely interesting reading on your site, and a whole bunch of other topics, frankly. But unfortunately, we are coming up against our time limit, so we're going to have to save those topics for another day. Before we close, please tell our listeners where they can find more of your work.
Well, Eric, we've been running itulip.com since 1998, and that would be the best place for folks to go to find out what we're doing.
Again, you can find EJ's work at www.itulip.com. But for now, we are out of time. If you'd like to suggest other advanced topics or guests for the next level, please email your suggestions to me through the Financial Sense website. For the Financial Sense NewsHour, I'm Eric Townsend.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense NewsHour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the NewsHour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.